Teachers around the world looking for new ways to reach more students have found one, right on their laptops.
We're going to go live multiple times to all of these schools around the world.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how a Florida university is planning to use Skype in the classroom. We'll also learn some history about Notre Dame Cathedral and spend an academic minute running out of scientists. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. So how exactly does someone prepare for a presentation via Skype in the classroom?
I am going to prepare by taking a deep breath, making sure I'm on, making sure I'm awake and ready to talk.
Rachel Adjison is a master's student in entomology and nematology at the University of Florida in Gainesville. She'll be part of this so-called electronic field trip, a long-distance seminar on the science of mosquitoes, which will be hosted by Skype in the classroom.
We have a couple, I think it's 2 to 3 classrooms can also sign up at one time. And so there's going to be a lot of potential students that we're going to be interacting with. And mainly we want to convey to them that, you know, we are scientists, but we are also very friendly people. And we want to be really relatable so that they do feel comfortable asking any of their questions and they do feel comfortable having the ability to maybe see themselves as scientists, too, if that's something that they're interested in.
Skype in the classroom, which has been around since 2010, allows students and educators to interact throughout a presentation from any place in the world. Dr. Jamie Luizzo is an assistant professor of agricultural communication at the University of Florida and is the faculty coordinator for this project. We spoke just before their first virtual field trip using Skype.
So I have a project called Streaming Science, and we have done electronic field trips before with iPads and video streaming software, but this is our first time to look at a Skype in the classroom model for doing electronic field trips. In the other way we used to do them, you can't necessarily see the children's faces that are participating. They would just type questions into us. And so we were missing a little bit of that face-to-face interactivity that Skype can provide. And so Skype, through their Microsoft Educator platform, it's a whole world of educators that are certified through Microsoft as being really great educators that use technology in their classrooms proficiently. And then Skype then offers these one-on-one calls between, you know, national parks, museums, universities, you name it, to these educators throughout the world that connect through Skype. And it's really exciting to know that something so simple as Skype, right, a face-to-face video call can actually afford this really experiential learning experience to connect scientists and content experts around the world with classrooms directly.
And this electronic field trip you're doing on mosquitoes, this is going to be the first time you're trying it, right?
Yes, this will be our first time to use it. So we go live to, I believe it's 3 or 4 schools around the world. Some of them are from Pakistan, Vietnam, all over the place, and then also Pennsylvania, Florida. But we're going to go live multiple times with Rachel and Andrea and Casey from their lab to all of these schools around the world. And we've tested the equipment ahead of time. We used part of March to work directly with Skype and talk to their staff to help us get ready. And then we tested from the lab to make sure it was going to work to different sites. And so this will be our very first time to actually go live to schools and give it a try.
And do you know approximately how many students will be joining in?
So I think we go live at two different times, and we might have about 60 students in total. Some of that is challenging until the teachers let us know who's there that day and what's really happening. But we're hoping, I think we're up to 13 or 14 schools registered, so that could potentially be a few hundred students. I just try to kind of underestimate and then just be surprised when it's more than we thought.
Plan for the worst, but hope for the best.
Exactly.
Exactly. And how interactive is this?
Well, that is something that we're going to explore. We do have sort of a outline for our scientists to be prepared to help us meet our learning objectives. So describing what mosquitoes are, what their life cycle is, what their habitat typically is, and the illnesses associated with them. So we do have a little bit of content we definitely want to cover and a little bit of a demonstration in the lab. But we do want the students to be able to feel like they can chime in and ask the scientist questions as we go through that content. But we definitely, every 5 to 10 minutes of the 45-minute program, hope to be calling out to the students, what kinds of questions do you have for us at this point from what we've shown you? So we really do want it to be more of a conversation and not just a program that feels like your teacher put in a DVD and they're making you sit here and watch it. We want it to actually be a two-way conversation where we let them ask us all kinds of stuff as we go throughout the content and show them around the lab.
And what are the age groups of the students you're expecting?
So we're mostly targeting middle and high school students because we do feel like some of the content helps us hit the Florida science education standards at that level and the next generation science standards when it comes to how a scientist works, the nature of science and science careers. But I have noticed we have had a couple of fifth grade classes sign up, and we're not going to turn anyone away. It's all a big experiment for us and something new that we are trying. While we know we're targeting certain standards, if a teacher in a school sees that this applies to something they're doing in their classroom, we're not going to say no. So we've pretty much accepted from fifth grade to about 10th grade classes at this point.
Is this something you can foresee being used as distance learning for, you know, degree, college credit?
Ooh, that's a tricky question. I don't know that it would be something that would be for college credit. I could see it being woven into classes to help expand something they might be doing in already existing classes for college credit if they want to bring a topic to life and introduce you to a major here at the university or to meet the scientists that are connected to something that's already being taught in the classroom. But I don't know that, you know, the Skype experience itself would necessarily lend itself to credit just yet. But who knows? The world of for-credit college experiences is changing all the time.
This might end snow days for kids up north. You're not coming to class, but turn your Skype machine on.
Yes, that would be excellent. You do hear, I mean, I'm from the north, and I do know that there are days you close down for snow, and so virtual academic days are truly a thing, and maybe this could still be a way to engage teachers and classes and scientists on days that you can't go anywhere. We do know that schools are cutting field trip budgets quite a bit these days, or there's not as much funding to get students to places. So we do definitely see the value of electronic field trips. When you can't take 100 students to an entomologist's lab, she wouldn't be able to cram all of them in her lab anyway. But we can do that through the beauty of Skype and two-way dialogue online and take students places they wouldn't be able to go otherwise. So we do think it's a pretty cool approach to still providing that, electronic field trip feeling of a field trip in your classroom.
Is this something that Skype and or Microsoft is offering? Is there a charge for this?
No, this is free for everyone. They just sort of set up a login and password and profile, and then they can get into the Skype in the classroom system, and you can book electronic field trips and guest speakers from all of the different offerings that are in their system.
Well, depending on how this goes, and by the time this airs, you will have already done it, so hopefully we can get a little update and see how it went.
Yeah.
Are you hoping to, plan more of these in the future?
Yes. So I do hope the Streaming Science Project lives on. The students in my science communication classes at UF create photo essays, videos, podcasts, and electronic field trips, and we put them on streamingscience.com for schools to use all over the place. And we hope to always offer at least 1 to 2 electronic field trips every year, whether it's our streaming model or the Skype in the classroom model. But we hope that we become a platform and a source that schools know to go to kind of expand their science education offerings with their students. And I don't know if any of it matters, but the Florida Department of Health is funding this project. And we have a center here at UF called the Public Issues Education Center, the PI Center. So those two are partnered, and that's where the funding came from to help us deliver the Science of Mosquitoes electronic field trips. Something I do love about this electronic field trip project is it's a new way of teaching and doing science communication. The undergraduates working with the graduate scientists, reaching out to middle schools and delivering a live sort of video-produced program is something that is really valuable, not just to the students that are watching and engaging, but also to the Rachels and the upcoming scientists and then my upcoming students that are going to be the next, you know, generation of science communicators. This project is pretty cool to watch all of it come together.
So how does someone prepare for a presentation in this format? Rachel Atchison says getting ready for this electronic field trip was unique.
It's a little different because this presentation is meant to be a lot more interactive. So generally when we are talking to scientists, we might have a PowerPoint presentation where we are describing our research, and then there's a couple of minutes for questions at the end. But this is really about connecting to students and allowing them to ask whatever questions they have. So most of it is going to be Q&A. And at the beginning, we're going to hit a couple of the learning objectives that we're hoping people that sign up can get out of the program. So, like, what is the mosquito life cycle like? What habitats do they live in? How can you prevent mosquito abundance so that we can prevent numbers of mosquito-borne illnesses in the area that you live in? And so we're in Florida, so my content area of knowledge is a lot about Florida mosquito-borne illnesses, but also generally mosquito biology is common. Like, they share the same biology, some of the same biology worldwide. And so we have some international classrooms signed up. And so I'm hoping that just talking about mosquito prevention techniques will also be applicable to them, while I might not be able to answer specific questions about mosquito-borne illnesses in their country.
Where did you find the participants? Obviously, it's not just at University of Florida.
Yes. Teachers worldwide that are signed up to get Skype in the classroom notifications were notified about our offering. Then they could say, oh, we're interested in this, or we're interested in this and we want to register for it. So that was really great. Using Skype in the classroom allowed us to sort of broadcast worldwide through their Skype network. And then also we have been doing different outreach here locally to let the local community know.
What do you think of the Skype in the classroom format? Is this something that you think is really going to catch on?
I hope so. I find that the most rewarding outreach activities that I do are one-on-one, going to visit a classroom or going to visit a small group. But I'm limited to only like my immediate community as far as where I can travel to do those outreaches. And so with Skype in the classroom, I can talk to students anywhere. And so it really just like broadens in the scope of who you can talk to.
Still to come, so how did the big mosquito presentation go? We'll find out next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Well, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org, click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and today we're talking about Skype in the classroom and how the University of Florida is using that platform to conduct virtual field trips for students around the country and really around the world. I checked back in with Dr. Jamie Luizzo to see how their presentation on mosquitoes turned out.
So we wrapped up our last one today. We had two classrooms in Canada, two classrooms in Pennsylvania, one Florida school, and a school in Pakistan.
And, well, first, technically, how did it run?
So we're actually really excited with how it ran. The schools can use Skype pretty easily. They do have to work with their IT person to make sure the firewalls and things are unblocked and that they're allowed to download and have Skype on their computer. People these days pretty much know how to use Skype, so it was a great tool to use and go with, and it's a video call. And it was really pretty informal. We loved that the scientists could say to the kids watching, "Do you have any questions for me?" Or the kids would just shout out their questions, and the scientists didn't necessarily have to have like a prepared, "I'm going to say exactly these things and give this lecture," but it was more of a conversation with the kids that were participating. And the kids had all kinds of really interesting questions about mosquitoes themselves. They needed to know, how big are they? How do you prevent them from biting you? All of those things. Am I more likely to be bitten by a shark than I am a mosquito or a megadon? So we had some really great questions from the kids, which made it a lot of fun and which made the Skype video call worth it, because then they could have those exchanges and they could see one another's facial features and laugh and or know when it was more of a serious question, and they could just really have that two-way engagement, which was really exciting to see.
How are your scientists going to do things differently next time?
That's a really great question. So part of the research we're doing with this is we collected surveys from the students, surveys from the teachers, and my graduate students are actually now going to interview the scientists about what went well, what didn't go well, what will we do differently next time. And I think some of it has to do with just being prepared for the different audiences that we have. We had everything from elementary to middle school to a men's dormitory school in Pakistan. And those are really amazing audiences to connect with, but they're also challenging in knowing what level your content should be at and what level your terminology should be at. So when it comes to connecting with the international schools, it's having a cultural understanding of where they are and what they're facing when it comes to different issues. So, for instance, the school in Pakistan mentioned mosquitoes keep them awake at night. They are so thick there, and they need to sleep with nets around their beds. So it was almost our scientists were engaging them and teaching them about the research being done at UF, but then they were also responding to us and teaching us about the issues they're facing in their country. So I think we need to do a little bit more research ahead of time about our audiences, which is always something you need to do in science communication. But then also, I think the technology on our end, we maybe need to give the teachers a little bit more of a handbook about how to get connected, or test with them a little bit earlier ahead of time to make sure everything's working on their end, because we did have a couple of schools that could not get into Skype correctly or didn't know how to find us on there. But otherwise, I think our scientists did a great job. They loved getting to talk to the students. They walked around the lab and showed them the lab, and they got to talk to the other graduate students working in the lab and see the bugs, and it was really pretty cool. But I definitely think more demonstration and more just getting things right for the correct age group that we're with on that particular call.
All right. So it sounds like any connectivity issues was their problem and not yours.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, fine. What's next?
Yeah, so we will do these again. We hope to do these every semester. I teach some science communication graduate level and undergraduate level courses, and we hope to have electronic field trips every semester from the students I work with. So we will do more Skype in the classrooms in the fall and the spring. We are still looking for what topics. So part of our survey to the teachers were, what other topics would you like to see us cover? And we heard everything from bees to water to forest conservation. So we're going to kind of go through some of that feedback and then look at what scientists we have here at UF that are doing the really cool cutting edge stuff. And we're going to offer more of these in the next year.
Dr. Jamie Luizzo is an assistant professor of agricultural communication at the University of Florida in Gainesville. You can learn more about Skype in the Classroom at education.microsoft.com/Skype in the Classroom. And don't worry, we'll put a link to that on our page at wamc.org. People around the world watched in real time as striking images of the burning spire at Notre Dame Cathedral were broadcast from Paris last month. Now officials are working to determine the extent of the damage and considering how to rebuild the roughly 800-year-old church. Dr. Michael Davis is a professor of art history and the chair of architectural studies at Mount Holyoke College in Western Massachusetts. Davis has published works on numerous cathedrals, including Notre Dame. He spoke to the best of our knowledge's Ray Graff about what's made this European landmark so notable.
I think Victor Hugo had it just about right when he cast Notre Dame in a starring role in his novel Notre Dame de Paris, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, where he really saw in the stones and the succession of styles and the long construction history really a kind of story of the birth of France as a nation state and the subsequent ups and downs, historical and political vicissitudes that really were reflected on its fabric and through its history.
I have read, and I have no idea if this is apocryphal, that some 12,000 oak trees were used to build the ceiling of the original cathedral. That's virtually a forest.
Right, right. That's in fact what they called the roof structure, le forêt, literally means the forest. And, you know, I don't know if 12,000 is an accurate number, but certainly a roof structure. And, you know, ironically, that was probably the most original and untouched part of the building that disappeared. It's one of the few roof structures, timber roof structures, to survive pretty much intact since the Middle Ages. And, you know, they estimate some of those trees, when they were felled in the late 12th or early 13th century, were maybe 400 or 500 years old at that point. And so we're looking at trees or timber that may have, you know, dated back to the 6th century.
In today's dollars, is there any way to estimate how much it cost to build the thing?
That's very difficult. I suppose a kind of maybe a better index would be to remember that, let's say, a good annual wage for a skilled master mason was about £10 a year in the 13th century. And I think annual construction costs at a building like Notre Dame maybe ran £1,000 or somewhat above per year. So you can kind of tell the relative value of things. It's hard to kind of translate that exactly, you know, from, you know, medieval currency and values into today's dollars. But it certainly would have, you know, run into the billions.
Most of us, most of the world, watched as the spire, fully engulfed in flames, fell, and the fire burned for hours. Yet there is optimism expressed that the cathedral will rise again, hundreds of millions of euros and dollars already being pledged for the rebuilding. In your opinion, what can be rebuilt and what is lost for good?
Well, certainly, I guess, the original fabric, grievously, the original timbers of the roof structure, those are certainly gone. But I agree that the damage was not as bad as I had feared. I mean, you looked at the pictures of the conflagration on the, you know, the television or a screen, and it just, you wondered if anything was going to survive that. But amazingly, it seems that the vaults, the stone ceiling over the interior space, came through in pretty good shape. I was certainly holding my breath and awaiting its collapse, because with the spire coming down onto the vaults and then the timbers and the roof structure falling onto the vaults, I thought, well, they're going to be gone too. But I think, you know, there's some cause for relief here about how the building came through that fire. But I think one has to be maybe a little cautious and wait for careful architectural inspection, especially the condition of the masonry, because when you, you know, superheat stone, it doesn't burst into flames, but it can calcify and really lose its structural integrity. So we'll see what, you know, experts find on an inspection about how much of the, you know, surviving structure, especially in the upper part of the building near the roof fire, might be salvageable.
Dr. Michael Davis is a professor of art history and the chair of architectural studies at Mount Holyoke College in Western Massachusetts. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Ray Graff. Advances in science are moving quickly, but we seem to be running out of research scientists to take these breakthroughs from the lab to the marketplace. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Medical innovations are on a downward trend. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Kerr Amsler, professor of biomedical sciences at the New York Institute of Technology, explores why.
The rapid introduction of new therapies and medical devices has created a surge in clinical research studies and many questions. Have practicing clinicians deemed these therapies both clinically safe and effective? Physicians trained in research can bridge the gap between exam room and laboratory. Many life-saving advances can be traced to physician scientists, clinicians who seek to introduce treatments by blending their clinical experience and biomedical research. Patient interactions allow them to identify areas in need of exploration and questions they can help answer in the laboratory. For example, studies by physicians Huggins and Hodges allowed hormone therapy to become the gold standard for patients with advanced prostate cancer. Yet, with fewer research clinicians entering the workforce, they've become an endangered species. The NIH finds that less than 2% of U.S. physicians report research as a primary focus. This downward trend is continuing, potentially causing medical innovation to stagnate. The reason for the decline is multifactorial. Physicians face ample barriers to conducting research, like disruption of clinical practice, difficulty obtaining funding, inadequate research training, and financial resources to fund both a medical and an academic degree. If educators fail to encourage medical students to conduct research parallel to their future clinical career, we will miss opportunities to cure deadly diseases such as cancer and HIV. However, institutions can help avert a shortfall by removing barriers, like offering dual medical and academic degree programs, research training, and tuition reimbursement. With these changes, universities can reassure medical students that research is worthwhile and that they can contribute to the next medical breakthrough.
That was Kerr Amsler of the New York Institute of Technology. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.